We come back to chapter 14, the passive and the active Brahman, a chapter which Sri Aurobindo did not edit in later years. So we read it as we found it in the Arya. If you remember, it was published on the 15th of January in 1917. So this was in the third year of the Arya that this came out. Sri Aurobindo, in the immediate passage preceding where we begin tonight, was describing how a perfect action can express a perfect peace. This is realizable, achievable to the yogic consciousness. He continues here, to the ordinary mind, this does not seem possible, as emotionally it cannot conceive of activity without desire and emotional preference. So intellectually it cannot conceive of activity without thought conception, conscious motive, and energizing of the will. But as a matter of fact, we see that a large part of our own action, as well as the whole activity of inanimate and merely animate life, is done by a mechanical impulse and movement in which these elements are not, openly at least, at work. In other words, nature does. Nature affects. It does not have to refer to the volitional mind to have permission to proceed. And this again goes back to an insight as old as Sankhya. It may be said that this is only possible of the purely physical and vital activity, and not of those movements which ordinarily depend upon the functioning of the conceptual and volitional mind, such as speech, writing, and all the intelligent action of human life. But this again is not true, as we find when we are able to go behind the habitual and normal process of our mental nature. It has been found by recent psychological experiment that all these operations can be effected without any conscious origination in the thought and will of the apparent actor. His organs of sense and action, including the speech, become passive instruments for a thought and will other than his. So the vehicle can be driven by nature without volitional interference from the mind. And if you look at this, of course, you're seeing in the way that he scales this hierarchy here, that this is a conscious referent to the Sankhya scheme of nature, Prakriti. Certainly, behind all intelligent action, there must be an intelligent will. Well, that's the buddhi in Sankhyan terminology. But it need not be the intelligence or the will of the conscious mind in the actor. In other words, buddhi functioning from nature achieves this. In the psychological phenomena of which I have spoken, it is obviously in some of them the will and intelligence of other human beings that uses the organs. In others, it is doubtful whether it is an influence or actuation by other beings, or the emergence of a subconscious subliminal mind, or a mixed combination of both these agencies. Subconscious and subliminal, even here, seem to have different connotations, yes. Subconscious meaning what is below. Sri Aurobindo, of course, in later innings of the Life Divine, as he revises it, of course, brings fully out what subliminal means to him there, not simply behind the line, but an inner nature investing itself in an outer nature and discoverable by a deepening consciousness. But we need not pursue that here. But in this yogic status of action by the mere organs, Kavalaya Indraya, this is going back to Bhagavad Gita, pardon me again, chapter 5, verse 11. It is the universal intelligence and will of nature itself working from centers superconscious and subconscious as it acts in the mechanically purposeful energies of plant life or the inanimate material form, but here with a living instrument who is the conscious witness of the action and instrumentation. So that he would combine superconscious and subconscious here in one frame suggests that there is no unbridgeable gulf between soul and nature, and in fact, this chasm between the two, Purusha and Prakriti, he does not accept. Remember, this chapter is titled The Passive and the Active Brahman, which means he sees all as unified in the reality of one omnipresent divine. And this division is something of a functional distinction. This is not an essential distinction. It is a remarkable fact that the speech, writing, and intelligent actions of such a state may convey a perfect force of thought, luminous, faultless, logical, inspired, perfectly adapting means to ends, far beyond what the man himself could have done in his old normal poise of mind and will and capacity. Yet all the time, he himself perceives, but does not conceive the thought that comes to him, observes in its works, but does not appropriate or use the will that acts through him, witnesses, but does not claim as his own the powers which play upon the world through him as through a passive channel. Again, this is his experience from Baroda on, from 1908 on. So one can live in the vacancy without egoistic interference and have the engine of nature spin out perfectly and without flaw all the thoughts that ought to operate through the mind without the conscious adhesion, without having to cook it up yourself, without having to sit and work out point by point what you want to say. In fact, Sri Aurobindo found this completely possible for him. As soon as within 3 days or so after achieving this nirvana, he returned to the political sphere and began again to give speeches. Political speeches that brought to awareness all the audiences that sat before him. And he never thought of a thing. He simply said the words that came to him. He was, in a sense, a passive channel through which these grand thoughts passed. And you can go back and look at the speeches dated from January 1908 on and see what has been recorded there, how brilliantly this mind worked without having to be the cook in the kitchen. But this phenomenon is not really abnormal or contrary to the general law of things. For do we not see a perfect working of the secret universal will and intelligence in the apparently brute jada action of material nature? And it is precisely this universal will and intelligence which thus acts through the calm, indifferent, and inwardly silent yogin who offers no obstacle of limited and ignorant personal will and intelligence to its operations. So because he is quiet, because he is still seated in the self, Nature can effectuate what it wills, and if this is, let us say, a higher nature, then beauty and truth flow out through the passive instrument without let or hindrance. He dwells in the silent self. He allows the active Brahman to work through his natural instruments, accepting impartially, without participation, the formations of its universal force and knowledge. So, this is not a description of the Purusha-Prakriti interaction. This is more a description of the Shakti of Atma expressing itself. One pole of the being watches. Shiva supports. The Shakti displays the energy. Shiva is not disturbed by the display of energy. Shakti is the expression of Shiva. The two are one. Power, conscious power, is this being which seems to be motionless, thrown into activity. The two who are one. He dwells in the silent self. He allows the active Brahman to work through his natural instruments. These are still his instruments. He has not quit possession of body, life, and mind. He accepts impartially, without participation. He is no longer the small ego thinking that he authors these actions. Now, a greater nature power expresses itself through his silent being. The formations of its universal force and knowledge. So this is a larger person. This is the cosmic all. This is Vasudeva. This status of an inner passivity and an outer action independent of each other is a state of entire spiritual freedom. The yogin, as the Gita says, even in acting does no actions, for it is not he but universal nature directed by the Lord of nature which is at work. This is Gita chapter 4, shlokas 17 and 18. And this is a Vedantic teaching, yes, because the two are one being. He is not bound by his works, nor do they have any after effects or consequences in his mind, nor cling to or leave any mark on his soul. They vanish and are dissolved by their very execution and leave the immutable self unaffected and the soul unmodified. So this is the yogin, freed from conditioning by the ego, not attached or identified with it. And, footnote 4, na karma lipyate nare, from the Isha Upanishad. This translates as, work does not adhere to you. Verse 2, I think. Footnote 5. Pravilyante karmani in the Gita. Actually, there's no such citation. That does not exist in the Gita. But it's probably a reference to Gita 4:23, chapter 4, shloka 23, where in English he says, rid of attachment, freed, his mind fixed in knowledge, doing acts for worship, his action all melts away. Karma praviliyate. Therefore, back to his paragraph here. Therefore, this would seem to be the poise the uplifted soul ought to take if it has still to preserve any relations with human action in the world existence. An unalterable silence, tranquility, passivity within, an action without, regulated by the universal will and wisdom which works, as the Gita says, without being involved in, bound by, or ignorantly attached to its works. And certainly, this poise of a perfect activity founded upon a perfect inner passivity is that which the yogin has to possess, as we have seen in the Yoga of Works. But here, in this status of self-knowledge at which we have arrived, there is an evident absence of integrality. For there is still a gulf, an unrealized unity, or a cleft of consciousness between the passive and the active Brahman. We have still to possess consciously the active Brahman without losing the possession of the silent self. We have to preserve the inner silence, tranquility, passivity as a foundation. But in place of an aloof indifference to the works of the active Brahman, we have to arrive at an equal and impartial delight in them. In place of a refusal to participate, lest our freedom and peace be lost, we have to arrive at a conscious possession of the active Brahman, whose joy of existence does not abrogate his peace, nor his lordship of all workings impair his calm freedom in the midst of his works. And we can go back to the Upanishads for this, the Taittiriya Upanishad, in its closing chapter. The very first verse of the Isha Upanishad begins like that. The difficulty is created by the exclusive concentration of the mental being on its plane of pure existence, in which consciousness is at rest in passivity and delight of existence, at rest in peace of existence. So this again, this is the smallness of the mind which chooses sat versus chit, sat versus ananda, can't be big enough to include the entirety of what is sat chit ananda, the description of Brahman as consciousness, true being and bliss, and so rests upon simply the experience of sat. It has to embrace also its plane of conscious force of existence, in which consciousness is active as power and will, and delight is active as joy of existence. Here the difficulty is that mind is likely to precipitate itself into the consciousness of force instead of possessing it. The extreme mental state of precipitation into nature is that of the ordinary man who takes his bodily and vital activity and the mind movements dependent on them for his whole real existence, and regards all passivity of the soul as a departure from existence and an approach towards nullity. So this mind's precipitation into the consciousness of force means that it experiences an engrossing identification with it, doesn't maintain its freedom and its vastness, but instead enters into the force of the movement, forgets the being, and has no sense of the ananda. He lives in the superficies. Isn't that a wonderful word? Based on the Latin, it means the surface without depth. He lives in the superficies of the active Brahman, and while to the silent soul, exclusively concentrated in the passive self, all activities are mere name and form, to him They are the only reality, and it is the self that is merely a name. In one, the passive Brahman stands aloof from the active and does not share in its consciousness. In the other, the active Brahman stands aloof from the passive and does not share in its consciousness nor wholly possess its own. Each is to the other in these exclusivenesses an inertia of status or an inertia of mechanically active non-possession of self, if not altogether an unreality. But the sadhaka, who has once seen firmly the essence of things and tasted thoroughly the peace of the silent self, is not likely to be content with any state which involves loss of self-knowledge or a sacrifice of the peace of the soul. He will not precipitate himself back into the mere individual movement of mind and life and body with all its ignorance and straining and disturbance. Whatever new status he may acquire will only satisfy him if it is founded upon and includes that which he has already found to be indispensable to real self-knowledge, self-delight, and self-possession. One can't help but chuckle because this is clearly autobiographical. Still, there is the likelihood of a partial, superficial, and temporary relapse into the old mental movement when he attempts again to ally himself to the activity of the world. So you can see he's working diligently to find a way to unify these two great realities, Atman and Atma Shakti, to make them one and the same. Here he goes. To prevent this relapse, or to cure it when it arrives, he has to hold fast, dharana, this is the power of concentration, he has to hold fast to the truth of Satchit Ananda and extend his realization of the infinite one into the movement of the infinite multiplicity. This is an act of will. Remember, one of the secrets of the Sankhya system is that the Purusha is not merely the Sakshi, the witness, but also the one who gives the sovereign assent, who gives the affirmative sign and says yes, can authorize. So there is, even in the system of Sankhya, the idea that the Purusha has power, the power to say yes or no to Prakriti, and maybe more. Sri Aurobindo, of course, doesn't begin with this experience of Purusha and Prakriti, distinguished one from the other, but begins with the realization of Brahman as a silent reality, and then proceeds to the realization of Brahman as a personal reality that is omnipresent in the world. How then to unify those is his challenge. What is the secret? And it is to apply the will, not simply to be the passive yogin watching it all, but to take the force implicit in consciousness and apply it to nature. So let's read that again. To prevent this relapse, or to cure it when it arrives, he has to hold fast to the truth of Satchit Ananda and extend his realization of the Infinite One into the movement of the infinite multiplicity. He has to concentrate on and realize the one Brahman in all things as conscious force of being, Chit Shakti, as well as pure awareness of conscious being, Sat Chit. The self as the all, not only in the unique essence of things, but in the manifold form of things, not only as containing all in a transcendent consciousness, but as becoming all by a constituting consciousness, this is the next step towards his true possession of existence. Transcendence and universality suffused. In proportion as this realization is accomplished, the status of consciousness, as well as the mental view proper to it, will change. So, to concentrate on and realize the one Brahman in all, this is something that worked for Sri Aurobindo, and as you sit silently in your meditation to realize the one as the reality, but then to extend and to discover that same one in all things, whether they are objects, whether they are thoughts, whether they are emotions, whether they embody themselves in complicated ways in your being. That is what you can do in part during your meditation. And then, when you come out from your meditation, to make the meditation active and see in this universal dance the same self displaying itself in multitudinous ways without losing its singularity. It is still just the one who has become the many. The many and the one are not separate, never have been, never could be. It is impossible. So, something for your practice when you sit passively, something for your practice when you take your yogic intention and become active. In proportion as this realization is accomplished, the status of consciousness as well as the mental view proper to it will change. Instead of an immutable self containing name and form, containing without sharing in them the mutations of nature, there will be the consciousness of the self, immutable in essence, unalterable in its fundamental poise, but constituting and becoming in its experience all these existences which the mind distinguishes as name and form. Isha Upanishad again. All formations of mind and body will be not merely figures reflected in the Purusha, but real forms of which Brahman, self, conscious being is the substance, and as it were, the material of their formation. The name attaching to the form will be not a mere conception of the mind, answering to no real existence bearing the name, but there will be behind it a true power of conscious being, a true self-experience of the Brahman answering to something that is contained potential but unmanifest in its silence. And yet, in all its mutations, it will be realized as one, free and above them. The realization of a soul reality, suffering the imposition of names and forms, Advaita Vedanta, will give place to that of eternal being, throwing itself out into infinite becoming. Isha Upanishad, verses 7 and 8, Taittiriya Upanishad, Mundaka Upanishad, Katha Upanishad. All existences will be to the consciousness of the yogin, soul forms, and not merely idea forms of the self, of himself, one with him, contained in his universal existence. All the soul life, mental, vital, bodily existence of all that exists will be to him one indivisible movement and activity of the being who is the same forever. The self will be realized as the all in its double aspect of immutable status and mutable activity. And it is this that will be seen as the comprehensive truth of our existence. So, two realizations fused, as in his personal example. The Yoga of Integral Knowledge. Yes, this Yoga of Integral Knowledge, it really is his yoga. So we have done with this chapter. The Cosmic Consciousness next time. Here's something that is akin, I think, in spirit to what Sri Aurobindo was writing about. This is in Savitri, Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 15, The Kingdoms of the Greater Knowledge. I think we're starting on page 299. On peaks where silence listens with still heart, to the rhythmic meters of the rolling worlds, he served the sessions of the triple fire. On the rim of two continents of slumber and trance, he heard the ever-unspoken reality's voice, awaken revelation's mystic cry, the birthplace found of the sudden infallible word, and lived in the rays of an intuitive sun. Absolved from the ligaments of death and sleep, he rode the lightning seas of cosmic mind and crossed the ocean of original sound. On the last step to the supernal birth, he trod along extinction's narrow edge near the high verges of eternity, and mounted the gold ridge of the world dream between the slayer and the savior fires. The belt he reached of the unchanging truth met borders of the inexpressible light and thrilled with the presence of the ineffable. Above him he saw the flaming hierarchies, the wings that fold around created space, the sun-eyed guardians and the golden sphinx, and the tiered plains and the immutable lords. A wisdom waiting on omniscience sat voiceless in a vast passivity. It judged not, measured not, nor strove to know, but listened for the veiled all-seeing thought, and the burden of a calm transcendent voice. He had reached the top of all that can be known. His sight surpassed creation's head and base. Ablaze the triple heavens revealed their suns, the obscure abyss exposed its monstrous rule. All but the ultimate mystery was his field. Almost the unknowable disclosed its rim. His self's infinities began to emerge. The hidden universes cried to him. Eternities called to eternities, sending their speechless message, still remote. Arisen from the marvel of the depths, and burning from the superconscious heights, and sweeping in great horizontal gyres, a million energies joined and were the one. All flowed immeasurably to one sea, All living forms became its atom homes. A panergy that harmonized all life held now existence in its vast control. A portion of that majesty he was made. At will he lived in the unoblivious ray. We'll continue that section next week. Namaste, Jai Ma.